supposed to be, what I try to be, what I thought I'd be, but I'll never be.
That was a song by Montreal's Blue Hawaii, and you are listening to In the Motherhood here on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's January 19th, a bit after 6 p.m. My name is Robin Fadden, and I'm your host for the show tonight. It's been a pretty tough month or so for parents here in Montreal and elsewhere with the resurgence of COVID and kids being home from school. Kids perhaps being sick, hopefully not in your household, and if so, I hope you're all recovered. But nonetheless, it's been tough times, and many parents, including myself, are feeling fairly stretched these days. So on today's show, I am featuring two pieces of content borrowed from Canadian community radio show Wings. The first one is a documentary from Australia produced by Heather Anderson, and it features organizers and clients of youth-oriented groups that deal with domestic violence. And the second piece of content is a speech by world-famous Black author and thinker Bell Hooks, who recently passed away. These are excerpts from her speaking in 1993, the year she published Sisters of the Yam, Black Women and Self-Recovery. So I invite you to listen to that in the second half of the show. And right now, I will get to the first documentary. Thank you for listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Domestic violence. A special report by Heather Anderson at 4ZZZ.
Change gonna come my way. Black woman, black life. Change gonna come my way.
Domestic Violence Prevention Week ran in Queensland from May the 7th to the 13th, a week of community education and prevention campaigns. On May the 10th, the Department of Families, Youth and Community Care presented 5 awards as part of the 4th Annual Domestic Violence Prevention Awards. I caught up with one of the awards recipients, Adele, from Young Mothers for Young Women.
A group of 12 young women who began parenting while they were still teenagers got together and did a participatory action research project which looked at the links between gender and violence in the lives of young mothers. And one of the major recommendations that came out of that research was to develop a peer network for young women, because it was found that that's where young women who are in domestic violence situations most turn to. They turn to their friends. And so it's just really grown from then. Now there's 3 of us that are still working on the project, and we basically just try to support other young women. And the most obvious way that we do that is we run a drop-in day every Tuesday. And it's similar to a play group, only it's limited to people under 25. On the Tuesdays we do things like have other people come in to do education workshops such as family planning, to talk about sexual health, all different things like that. Last year we ran a 12-month project looking at educating young women about healthy relationships in an effort to combat some sort of domestic violence. We did some really informal research about how young women want to hear about domestic violence, and basically we ran some workshops on domestic violence and no one turned up, and we started to think that young women don't want to hear about domestic violence, or they won't come to something titled about domestic violence. So throughout the workshop we just talk about healthy relationships and what does a healthy relationship look like. A lot of young women say that they just don't know what it looks like. Their parents didn't have a healthy relationship. You don't see healthy relationships on television all too often. And so unless you know what it looks like, it's a little hard to get it and then even maintain it. Towards the end of the workshop, we do a little bit of education on that violence isn't just physical, it's emotional and financial and all those sort of things, because we found if you spoke of violence, young women only pictured physical or sexual abuse, whereas they didn't realise that the financial and emotional stuff is abuse as well. So hopefully we've been able to educate some women about what violence is, but then also to look at how to maintain a healthy relationship and how to get a healthy relationship. We've just started to focus lately on celebrating relationships, because all of the young women that come to the drop-in day, they all have at least one relationship in their life that's healthy and worth celebrating, but because their relationship with their partner may not be so good and may not be worth celebrating, they tend to get bogged down in the negative aspects of that. Whereas we're saying to them, well, look, you've got this wonderful healthy relationship with your child, let's celebrate that. And if we can celebrate that, maybe we can take those characteristics and they can go into intimate relationships.
Do you think that starting a family young and the stereotype of the single mother and the you don't know what you're doing, you're too young, puts pressure on people to stay in relationships that might not necessarily be healthy?
Definitely. It was actually one of the things that came out of the original research. We call it the pixie photo trap. When you begin parenting young, you get a lot of flack anyhow. So it's very important that you maintain that picture of a perfectly happy family. I mean, it seems to me, and the research seemed to show, that that is so much more important to young women, to present that pixie photo. And that also influences young women to getting help if there's violence in their house, because not only do they not want to leave, but they don't want to get help, because that's admitting that their photo isn't perfect. Your educational employment opportunities are much lower once you've had a child so early. So for a lot of women, it's their only option to be someone is their family. And a lot of young women just don't want to leave violent relationships, and we started to find that a lot of domestic violence services will only assist and support a young woman or a woman if she is prepared to leave the violent relationship. Whereas we sort of think, well, let's give young women the skills and hopefully they can take that home, and their partner can take some of those skills on, and they can create that relationship together.
I also caught up with Julie and Betty from the Zigzag Young Women's Resource Centre in Brisbane, and asked them about providing support for younger survivors of domestic violence.
Often young women report that when they go to general shelters, they're not feeling comfortable, particularly when they do have children of their own, and they may be feeling uncomfortable with their parenting skills, housed in such close proximity with other women who have children. It's important to consider what their specific housing needs are.
I guess in terms of just coming to the service or having access to the service, it's also about their need for flexibility. And I guess the other thing is just about the environment, a comfortable environment where they feel safe. And that's quite often different to what generic services or generalist services provide, that they often feel that the space that's creative, that's, got posters all over the wall, that kind of thing, is also important to them.
I think also that it's important to consider that young women are disadvantaged doubly. Socioeconomically, they're, more inclined to be living in poverty because of their gender, but also because of their age, that they're more likely to be sole parents and the primary child carers. They're more likely to be in part-time work. And so therefore, when young women are fleeing domestic violence situations and trying to get safe, secure, affordable housing, all of those things impact on their success in fleeing the situation. Often young women are more likely to stay in a violent situation.
And it's not that older women don't tend to stay in situations of domestic violence, that's also very true. But I guess it's also very hard for them because of the lack of support out there in trying to flee that situation, that they often don't have the support of their families because the mother's also experiencing domestic violence, so they're also doubly at a disadvantage because they don't have that support from their parents either.
So what do younger women themselves have to say?
It wasn't when I was born, it was more so when my brother was born. So I was about 6 or 7, about 8, around that time when it really started to kick in, and I'd never seen anything like it before. I didn't know how to react, and it was just kind of like, whoa, this isn't exactly right, is it, you know? It started getting to the point where he was starting to take it out on me, and my mum just said, look, I'm going to have to send you to your grandparents. It's only up the road, you know, but you'll be away from it and all. And I mean, that was hard for me because, I mean, I really liked my mum and I really, you know, my brothers and sisters. And then a couple of years later, my sister ended up moving in with me. And the worst thing is that my brother has to put up with it. He's 14 and it still goes on to a certain extent. It's not as bad as it used to be. There aren't places for people to go once they've decided to leave. They might not have the support network. And the domestic violence order is a joke, you know. Yeah, you can get a restraining order, but it doesn't prevent him from getting a gun, staking you out, you know, absolutely flying off the handle. So you've got the option of, okay, packing up everything and just moving, changing your life, changing your names. And a lot of people don't have money to do that. I mean, it was common in my house, have an overnight bag packed, a louver that was out so you could escape. That's not normal, you know, having to live in a situation like that, but that was what it was at the time, you know. When you're 9, you don't really have a lot to say. You don't really have a voice either, you know.
And, I mean, the amount of people who just stay in situations where their parents are hitting them and they stay there because they haven't got any option, they've got nowhere to go, they haven't got the money, and it's frightening to go out there and try and do it.
I've had heaps of violence happen in front of me, like, at home, like, I saw my mum get murdered.
In society today, everyone is so angry and everyone's so on the edge that they just snap at nothing. And that's what I found with my dad, is I'd have to tiptoe around and just hope that I wouldn't trigger anything off, because once I did, he'd drink one weekend and he'd get into a fight, and then the next weekend it would all blow up and it would be hitting. And he was like, you know, my mum would leave and we'd be left in the house and he'd be trying to break her car apart, and I'd be out there like, you know, stop it, Dad, what are you doing? And he's, I hate you, I hate your mum, I hate your brother, I hate the whole lot of you. And it's just having your father look at you and just say, I hate you, like that, was just awful. I wouldn't be where I am today if I didn't have the friends that I have.
Ever since I did an assignment about capital punishment and things like that and jails, I just thought, why can't we put that money into making families better, but not in a conventional way? Putting money into making families feel whole and counselling and giving more benefits to them so they don't have worries about money, so they beat their wife or have to have addictions, because a lot of it's cyclic. Like, a lot of people who beat their wives, their parents did exactly the same thing.
Going to hurt my babies anymore. Not while I can do something about it. Oh, you want something to eat? You're there, cook.
I think domestic violence is a really big issue, and young people are seeing it in their families, seeing it happen to their mums and dads, or seeing it happen to their mothers in particular. And often what happens is that cycle continues then when those children grow up, because they don't see any other positive ways of dealing with their feelings and dealing with emotions and dealing with anger. It's all they know how to do, and that's really sad, I think. I was in a domestic violence relationship for a few years, and I myself had seen it in my family, and my partner had seen it in his family. So yeah, that's why we found each other. I never before that time could really understand why women would stay with partners who hit them and were violent towards them, but when you are in that situation, you can understand it, because if you really do love somebody, sometimes you are willing to make one incident, and you might have a history together and you've got all this emotional involvement.
What support did you receive?
I didn't really look for support. I just felt I didn't have anyone to talk to. I didn't want to talk to my friends because I felt they would tell me to leave. I didn't want to talk to my mother because she would probably tell me to leave, and I suppose deep down I didn't really want to leave, so I didn't really have any support.
My spirit can survive living with you for 18 years, then I can survive anything. Maybe you taught me that.
If there's any advice I can give to anyone who's out there who has children and is staying in that situation, it's don't. It's get out, and you know, your children should be the most important thing to you. And I understand that the house probably is as well, but, you know, when push comes to shove, you've really got to think, what kind of effect is this having on my children, you know? Is it stuffing them up psychologically, emotionally making them unbalanced, you know?
I think that we need to look after our young people today. Once you find a safe environment, everything works for you.
Just being taught what's classed as violence and stuff. I mean, this school kids could have a fight in a schoolyard, and that they wouldn't really know that that's classed as assault. They could be put up for assault charges.
There are supports for women in domestic violence situations, but for young women, they feel that it's just not really for them. They think going to a women's refuge or talking to a support worker from a refuge is really for women who are married and who have kids and who need to get away. But for young people, I suppose if there was people to talk to at their uni or at college or at school, people they could talk to about lots of different things, at least if they know there's somebody around, then they might be more likely to talk to them if they feel like they're not going to be judged and things like that. There are like young women specific domestic violence workers and things like that, but it's just that a lot of people don't know that they're there.
I don't have a problem when I walk around because I've done self-defence martial arts, and so when I walk around, if someone tried to do anything, I would fight them off, and I know that. That's just something I know. And I'm thinking about having, like, a meeting for young females and getting them all together and just seeing how they feel walking around on the streets at night, whether they feel safe or not, and then seeing whether people would want to have self-defence classes based for females walking around on the streets at night, how to look after themselves, how to feel assertive, how to feel like they have the right to be there.
You know it, you're in the wrong situation at the wrong right time. You know, it shouldn't be happening, but because you do feel really alone when that stuff's happening to you. And it's not as if I would have gone to a support group or anything and said, oh, this is what happened to me, but maybe more slogans around the place. I don't know, I see a lot of people getting charged in the papers and stuff from molesting kids and stuff, but I don't see any campaign saying, did you know that it's not accepted in this society that you molest your children? More about what is accepted and what really goes on, I suppose, behind all the closed doors. Yeah.
I think a lot of people need some relationship skills. They need to be taught, like, about sexual abuse, sexual harassment, what's classed as it, what's classed as violence, rah-rah.
I think telephone lines are a good thing, because if you got a telephone line, like a 1-800 number, it should be right there in the front of the phone book. People go into schools and talk to young women about it from like grade 8 onwards or even younger, so that kids who are seeing their mum being bashed up every night and they get really scared, they can like ring this number, a general violence number or help number, and you can ring that number and you know that if you're in trouble or if you need to talk to somebody, there'll be somebody there, and they can then give you maybe another number for somewhere to stay, things like that if you need help. But it would need to be 24 hours. I think that might be the best type of way of making something accessible, a 24-hour phone line, because nearly everyone has access to a phone nowadays. It's handy to have a common number in your wallet rather than... There might be a support worker at your uni or at school, but when you need them at midnight, they will be asleep, you know?
Reclaim the night, reclaim the night. Reclaim the night, reclaim the night. Reclaim the night, reclaim the night. Reclaim the night, reclaim the night.
Reclaim the Night, I think, is great. You can just go out with your girlfriend and know, okay, this is cool. I can walk down this street. I'm with a whole heap of other women. Who's going to take on an angry bunch of women, you know? And, you know, it's always good to see toddlers, little kids and stuff, and even young male toddlers, I think, is a really good thing, because I think males today just need to get in touch. You know, a lot of them are just, oh, I'm this big macho thing, who cares? As long as you understand that, okay, women want the right to go out and participate in whatever, you know, and we live in a violent society, we've got to start doing something to counteract that.
Not your right, our right, our right. Not your right, our right, our right.
Finally, I spoke to Kate Gilmore, Chief Executive Officer of Amnesty International in Australia.
Domestic violence, by its very nature, is a violation of fundamental human rights.
And would you support Amnesty International in Australia taking up this cause of defining domestic violence as a human rights abuse?
Well, in fact, Amnesty International, of course, is only one of many organisations within Australia which has identified to the Australian public, and in particular to government, that domestic violence is a violation of human rights. Amnesty International's particular role in drawing a connection between domestic violence and human rights is the role of the international. We monitor human rights violations in a range of settings, and monitor the reality that domestic violence is a common expression of persecution of women, one which is intolerable, unacceptable, and quite illegal under the framework of international law.
Now, there's already legislation against domestic violence in Australia. How would the definition of that offence as being a human rights abuse affect this legislation?
Well, there's three important messages that a human rights framework built around domestic violence gives us. The first thing is that all domestic violence legislation should not be assessed just against itself. It should be assessed against the bedrock of international standards. So legislation pertaining to criminal assault in the home should be tested for its efficacy and fairness against international standards such as the Convention Against Torture, the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. These sorts of treaties provide us with a benchmark, a minimum standard, if you like, that all our legislation pertaining to the protection of Australians' human rights must be assessed. So that's the first thing. The second thing that human rights reminds the state and the populace of as a framework is that it is indeed a crime against the individual citizen, and therefore a crime against the state. It's been a long, hard haul for women in Australia to have due recognition that domestic violence is a crime. Referencing it into the context of international human rights law reminds us the responsibility for ending these crimes against women lies fairly and squarely with the state. It becomes a very important tool for us to encourage the state to meet its obligations, to recognise them, and to resource services and programs necessary to fulfil those obligations. But the third important thing is it reminds every Australian citizen that we share in common, inalienably, we share in common with every other citizen around the world these same universal rights, and that no culture, no religion, no tradition can ever justify the physical, sexual, emotional, economic abuse of women and children in the home. This is a right that you and I share, but we share it with the women of India, with the women of Nepal, with the women of Pakistan, with the women of America, and with the women of the United Kingdom. These are universal rights that no one has any authority to strip us of. Not our husbands, not our fathers, not our brothers, nor our governments, nor the police, nor any other nation state.
How much weight do you think that these rights and these protections actually have with the Australian government?
Well, I think the very fact that the government has found it so difficult to stomach even mild criticism of its performance under these key covenants, its reaction has been so defensive and arguably to the point of an overreaction, that evidence suggests in fact the power, goes to support the argument that the treaties and conventions are very powerful. And we don't have to be experts in human rights law to see that. We just have to understand the psychology of peer group pressure. What international human rights law brings and the treaty mechanisms brings onto the international stage is a system of peer group pressure. It involves the peers of the Australian government, wherever, in other words, governments all over the world, scrutinising Australia's performance against these benchmarks. And Australian governments of all political persuasions find it very, very difficult, embarrassing, shameful when they are criticised. It's the power of that external objective scrutiny that we need to bring to bear on issues such as domestic violence in order to protect the human rights of Australian women and children.
And just finally, how do you see the balance between fighting domestic violence through legislation and human rights covenants and working to avoid it happening in the first place?
Well, we know that social change involves a matrix or a web of activity. The sorts of redress and adjudication that a justice system can offer post the commission of a crime is a real point of last resort. It's a thoroughly insufficient response, but it's a minimum response. We do know the rule of law must be present and active in a society in order that that society be fair, free and equal. So the rule of law and its application to domestic violence is absolutely essential to the social integrity of the Australian community. But neither the police nor the courts can prevent domestic violence on its own, although they can act as a key disincentive. What we do need is leadership from government against violence, leadership from government and community opinion leaders on the status of women, affirmation that women and children are equally entitled to human rights with their male, as are their male counterparts. And we do need an Australian community well acquainted with their fundamental rights. We need an Australian community aware and actively engaged in defending and advocating their rights as defined under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Me actively defending and expressing my rights, so long as I don't do so at the expense of your rights.
He beats me so hard, so often I don't remember my natural skin colour. I know I should have left years ago. I should have thought of the kids. But I've been thinking a lot lately. I've made plans. I'm gonna do what every self-respecting woman should do. I'm not leaving today or tomorrow.
In this program, you've heard music from Australian artists Isis, Mothman, Purple Revolution and Ruby Hunter, as well as samples from the New Zealand movie Once Were Warriors. This is Heather Anderson, reporting for Wings.
That documentary by Heather Anderson first aired on the women's program of 4ZZZ in Brisbane, Australia.
Dad, could I talk to you for a minute? I just wanted to say thanks, Dad. Thanks for the values you've taught me. Thank you for teaching me that it's okay to let someone treat me with disrespect. That it's okay to let someone put me down and even hit me. And that it's okay to let someone rob me of my self-esteem and step on my dreams and make me feel worthless. Just like you do to Mom. You've been a great example. I'll probably marry someone just like you. Thanks, Dad.
If you would like information about the cycle of generational abuse or are seeking help and information for someone you know, call the Awake Crisis Line at 272-0100. There is hope.
That public service announcement was produced at the Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation Training Center by Terry L. Schreiner. It aired in South Central Alaska in 1999 and won a Golden Reel Award from the U.S.'s National Federation of Community Broadcasters in April 2000.
Since this program was produced, there are more domestic violence hotlines available. The U.S. has a national one, 1-800-799-SAFE. If you're frightened of surveillance, search for hotlines in your area using private mode.
You've been listening to Wings, a weekly radio program by and about women around the world.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Bell Hooks died on December 15, 2021, at her home in Berea, Kentucky, at age 69. Many obituaries list her credentials, her influence, and her 30 or so books. People are posting favorite Bell Hooks quotes all over social media. Hooks is also justly famous for her blunt, clear, and loving lectures.
How many times do we separate from each other because we don't want to do the work of confronting? Because confronting may be bringing pain. How many times do white women and women of color say to me, well, you know, I just dropped out of this because I couldn't deal with those white women anymore. And yet, we will hang into relationships working with them. I said, how many of us have an intimate relationship where we never get angry? Where we never have impulses of rage? What we believe is that even in the midst of those impulses of anger or rage, it is our greater good, our collective feeling of care that will guide us. Why don't we feel the same thing in our movements? Why don't you feel the same thing at those meetings when you are locking heads with women of color and men of color over issues of difference? Around racism, around classism. Why don't bourgeois black women who are confronting working class women who say, you don't understand our issues, feel that same willingness to believe that the overall feeling of commitment and care can guide us through dissent, chaos, and crisis? Why do we allow those things to fall apart often? Why do we say, well, I won't try to do that anymore? You know, I had a young black bourgeois woman tell me I went somewhere to help these women, you know, and they were just so hostile. And I said, well, did you think about the way you framed it? Did you think about the location that you were coming from? And why with one attempt are you willing to give up? Do you give up that way in the relationships of intimacy in your life? Don't we struggle in the midst of patriarchy? Don't many of you who are heterosexual struggle with men daily, believing and hoping eternally that you can bring some greater good to the situation, and yet we don't bring that same eternal hope and conviction to our movement?
From the Wings Archive, bits of wisdom from the late Bell Hooks.
What does it mean that people can see so much violence and yet be aware of it but not feel compelled to change it?
Bell Hooks addressing the Texas Council on Family Violence in 1993.
People like you, people like those feminist activists who began the battered women's movement, have been truly successful in that we now have a culture that fundamentally acknowledges the reality of violence against women. People really do acknowledge today, most people, that incest happens, that domestic battery happens. Even people who don't want to have anything positive to say about feminism will acknowledge these realities. The difficulty we face is how do we move that acknowledgement past mere recognition into the willingness to do something every day of your life to change violence. And that is what I do not see. I have never forgiven Donahue, our, you know, talk show liberal male feminist, for that moment on his show when Scheherazade Ali was on there saying that sometimes black women need to be hit in the mouth. And there was Haki Madhubuti from Third World Press saying, indeed, I don't sell her books in my store because they condone violence against black women. And Donahue fixed that camera on him and he said, that's censorship. And my class and I have looked at that moment and we've talked about how in that moment on national television, What Donahue actually did with his camera and with his symbolic power was to say, violence against women is not a real political issue. Now, censorship and free speech, that's a real political issue. Did many of you see the film Thelma and Louise? There is that moment in Thelma and Louise at the beginning that to me is so powerful. When the attempted rape has been interrupted, and I'm forgetting right now which one of them, Thelma or Louise, says to the violent, battering, abusive white male at that moment, when a woman is crying, she's not having a good time. And to me, that was one of those magical moments in cinema and in film where I felt that anybody looking at that moment could click. It could click. Like, you could get it. Like, wow. I suddenly realized that, in fact, when people are crying, often it signals perhaps that they're in pain, that they are sad, that something is wrong, that something is out of place. And I thought, this is the power of mass media, that it can make you feel for a moment something that can turn on that light bulb. But then I felt that what ultimately happened is the film then proceeded to undercut that moment throughout by making it seem like, well, guess what, world? Women are just as violent as men. Women are just as willing to humiliate men. Women will, you know, and I see this as a major theme running through how mass media is dealing with the issue of violence right now, saying things to us like, men may be violent, but women are so violent too. And if women only had the power men had, they would be just as violent. So I've been thinking a lot about the naturalization and the normalization of violence. What I think is happening in our culture is that people feel incredibly powerless to change it because they feel like it is normative. They feel like it is natural. I can't tell you how many people say to me that, don't you think the impulse to hit, or that's just a natural thing, and that's just how boys are going to be. And I think about all the incredible work we've done within feminist movement, within the movement of domestic violence, to try to undercut that, and the message has still not gotten across to people, that it is not normative, that it is not natural, the act of doing violence. I'm willing to even allow that the impulse can be talked about as a, quote, natural impulse. I've been feeling very violent myself lately. And in fact, I've written a piece called Killing Rage, because I feel deeply enraged about the things that are not changing in this society. I had an experience recently that was the subject of this essay, and I want to talk about it here because I want to talk about how racism within and without the movement to end domestic violence continues to keep us apart. I got on an airplane with a black woman friend, and we were seated together in first class. We had those upgrades. And she had not been given a boarding pass. We were sitting in our little seats, and another black woman got on, and a white male was sitting in her seat and refused to move. The black woman was very nice. She said, that's okay, I'll sit anywhere, da-da-da-da-da. And I have to say that even other white fellow white passengers asked this man to move. He was obstinate that he would not move. Then a white man got on who had a boarding pass for the seat that my friend was sitting in. He came to our sides and said, you're sitting in my seat. And she said, oh no, I was given this seat. And then a few minutes later, she was called to the front of the plane. I said to her, don't move. She didn't listen to me. She moved. She went up, and it was explained to her that she was in this gentleman's seat. And while the stewardess were neatly negotiating our body space, he went and sat in the seat with her purse, with her belongings. Everybody was looking at us on the plane. We were the difficult, angry black women who were up there discussing this. And it was very clear that nothing was going to happen. And I went back to my seat. And Mr. Smiling Liberal White Man, no doubt a feminist man in his imagination, says to me, you know, he says, I'm so sorry.
it's unfortunate, but, you know, I didn't really have anything, you know, to do with this. I said, don't tell me you're sorry. You watched her being humiliated. You watched them call her up to the front of this plane. And you didn't say there's no need for humiliation here. I'm willing to sit elsewhere. Or you didn't say, I want my seat because I've been assigned to it, but I don't like what's taking place here. I don't condone what's taking place here. I said, no, that seat was so important to you. And he had that little grin of, I didn't let those, you know, wild black women, you know, get my seat. He had triumphed. And I felt rage towards him. And I'm going to be honest with you, if I could have killed him, I would have. And I don't say that lightly, and I don't say that. It didn't amuse me. I was scared that I felt that his refusal to see how racism and sexism work in this society and classism welled up in me so much that I felt murderous rage. And I'm telling you that everybody around me knew that I felt murderous rage because it was coming out of my pores. And I had never felt that in my life before. And it was one of those things where on one level it was trivial, but deep within me, it was like all those incidences of a failure to understand difference and solidarity and what it means. And I just began to weep intensely. Because I felt that why are we still having to deal with this? Why aren't people more aware? And I got out my pen and I began to write this essay that was called Killing Rage, Moving from Pain to Power. Because I feel that we have to hone our rage. We have to use it as a tool for vision and insight and understanding. This essay is a fine piece of work that came out of that rage. And I think that when we try to suppress our rage, it's when the dilemmas in our lives start. But one of the things that I've been thinking about, and I wanted to say, I also felt estranged from the black woman friend that I was with. I thought, why did she choose them over me? Why didn't she listen to me when I told her not to move from her seat? And I thought, why am I so angry at this injustice, and she seems to be more willing to conform? And at the end of the plane, I waited for her. And all these people came out, and all of a sudden I heard these voices screaming and yelling. And she came out, and she was in this intense battle with the stewardesses about racism and sexism. Because what had happened to her is when she went back to take the seat they said was hers, a white family was sitting there with their children. And do you know what they asked her? Would you be willing to give up your seat so this family can sit together? And she gave up her seat because she felt like she didn't really have any stake in the seat. But it enraged her that at no point was that white man asked, would he be willing to give up his seat so we could be together? Would he be willing to give up his seat so we wouldn't have to be humiliated publicly? In fact, he was invested in our humiliation. And I know that many of you out there have had these same struggles around race on your job. With the projection onto black women and black people in general that we are too angry, that we want something for nothing, that we disrupt the harmony of gatherings with our critiques. People tell me all the time, I'm just so tired of hearing black people talk about racism. You know, and that right there makes me get angry. You tired of hearing people talk about racism? We are tired of experiencing racism. And we are tired of the ignorance about the connection between violence against women and the violence of racism and classism, because they converge. And I think that those of us who work around these issues see how they converge within us. I mean, look at the movement for domestic violence in this society. It has been a movement traditionally dominated by white women at the top and women of color as the victims, the people coming for services. That's how many people perceive of it. So what happens then when revolutionary, insightful women of color and black women come into such a movement and want to shake things up and want to deal with issues in a different way? We know what happens. Confusion, anger, hostility, an end to discussion. I mean, the three words that I kept thinking about today in relation to talking to you was courage, challenge, commitment, four words, and confrontation. Because I think that part of why we have not furthered our will to end violence in this society is we are afraid of confrontation. We are afraid of the violent feelings we have in ourselves towards one another within this movement. I said this morning to a group of black women I was talking to, I believe that white women have tremendous feelings of violence towards black women. The sense that black women need to be silenced, that we're too uppity, that we need to be closed down in some way. I see that same spirit of violence in black men often. Close these black women down, shut them up. They're getting out of order. They're trying to take over. I said to my sisters this morning, how many times do I go to give a talk where a white woman says to me, there's a black woman in my office and she's just so angry. She's, you know, we really want to work with her, but she's just so difficult. And this happens again and again and again. And I think, my God, haven't white women read our literature? Don't they understand the roots of this anger? You know, we used to think, and I think this is one of the things that's plaguing feminist movement and the movement to end domestic violence. We used to think that if you just put the knowledge in front of people, people would change. And what we find is knowledge does not in and of itself change people. People are altered through practice, through experiences, because you can have all the knowledge of something up here in your head. I can't tell you how many white women I encounter daily who have knowledge, book knowledge of racism, but who don't understand how they manipulate in meetings or what have you with silence, with smiles. You know, people, my students used to say, always say that if black women are talking rapidly, loud, aggressively, they see that as negative action. But if a white woman is talking a lot and she's smiling and she's quiet, they don't see her as potentially occupying space, asserting power, because we think of power differently. Last night we had a deep discussion, Joe, Sheila, Judy, and I, about the question of differences and commonalities. And I couldn't sleep because I was thinking about this discussion, because it does seem to me that women all over the world share commonalities in our suffering, that when we suffer at the hands of patriarchy, at the hands of male violence, there is nothing unique and special about the form and nature that our suffering takes. It is common. The problem becomes the reality of that shared suffering does not mediate the differences, the different ways we understand that pain. A black woman who may be battered by a black man but who feels that she can't call a white police structure. That may be very different from a white woman who feels like, well, you've got to call that structure, who doesn't understand that moment of hesitation, that reflection about what it means. You know, the commonality that black men and black women share, we share commonly the suffering to end racism. And yet, I talk to black men daily who say to me, they go on and on about white supremacy, and I say to them, but what about the issues confronting black women? And they'll say to me, well, black women are in cahoots with white men. And suddenly, there's a gendered reading of the experience of racism which says black men suffer more. And somehow black women are getting away with a lot. And I think this is so sad given the reality of our experience. Why can't they recognize the different ways black women suffer? I hear black men and black people tell me all the time, well, you know, black men, if black men are violent towards black women and children, it's because the man is on them, because white supremacy is just hurting them so much. And I said, I don't buy that. White supremacy is hurting black women every day of our lives. But many of us do not go home and shoot and kill and maim and mutilate and beat. So what does that mean? You know, I have had to look back at my mother.
who worked as a maid for white people. And when she came home from her little jobs, she used to be so bubbly and full of joy. And as a child, I had no idea that there might have been some violence to her spirit and herself and her humanity on that job. It never occurred to me to think about white female violent assault on the personhood of black women, because the way she came home never suggested that I've just been denigrated. I've just been told to eat my little sandwich in the kitchen after I have prepared an elegant meal for the white family. She never conveyed any sense of what was done to her in that setting that might have made it extra hard for her to come home and be bubbly and share her little treats and give us that sense that all was right with our world. And what that says to me is that there is something within us that can handle our impulses to be violent, that can transform that rage into a generosity of spirit, love, and care. And if black women are capable of making that leap, then black men must be capable of making that same leap. And we must not buy into any structure that tells us that somehow black male violence against women is justified because of the pain black men experience at the hand of white racism. One of the things that we stayed up late into the night debating was the question of female violence against children. We were in disagreement about the enormity and the intensity of that and whether it was akin to male violence against women and children. Those of you who know my work, who've read my chapter on violence and feminist theory from margin to center, know that I am of that school that believes that part of the problem we have in ending violence is that so many women believe that violence is an acceptable means of social control. Even if they don't believe it is acceptable in their personal lives, they may feel that it's acceptable in the world beyond their lives. They may see young people, like those young black females we saw on Donahue who would kill people. And the white women in that audience had no trouble standing up saying they should be locked away forever, that their lives should be taken away, that they should be punished beyond all belief. That's an endorsement of violence. But it's the notion of the acceptable violence, the violence that makes us safe, that makes us feel good. Part of what I feel we have to confront is how can we enable people to see the interlocking nature of violence? So many white women and other groups of women can be against the violence of sexism, but have no trouble with the violence of racism, have no trouble actively assaulting other people of color, verbal assault, when it's in their interest to do so.
On Wings, excerpts from Bell Hooks' keynote address to the Texas Council on Family Violence in 1993. She went on to deconstruct a current sitcom that normalized rejection of black women and transvestites, and a recent film that created entertainment from the slaughter of a black gay man and a Korean couple.
I live on a corner that has a Korean grocer. I had never witnessed any kind of negative encounter between black youth and those store owners, but once that film came into being, every time I went in, it's not so much that people look at violence and think that it's not wrong. They may look at it and think that it's wrong, but it's so exciting. It's so pleasurable. It's more intense and more fulfilling than any kind of effort towards nonviolence could ever be. I think that this is a deep and profound moment. How do we intervene on that seduction of violence? I had to ask myself, I watch a lot of films. Would I 10 years ago have wanted to kill that white man on the plane? Or would I have believed that with my Christianity of that time, with everything, I could convert him? Why was my immediate impulse so deeply violent? And I think it has to do with the intimacy of violence in all our lives, the normative nature of it, the way it creeps up in all our interactions. I want to close by saying that I thought a lot about, why have we been so afraid of facing that violence within ourselves that comes up? Black female hatred and anger towards white women, the violence that comes up in these meetings, The violence when you just feel like, I wish I could go over and slap her. I wish I could pull her hair. I wish I could make her understand. Is that violence so radically different from the violence a batterer feels? I was talking on the phone and I found that this boyfriend of mine that I'm breaking up with had told me another lie, and I kept thinking, I wish I could beat him to death with this telephone. I wish I could just start pounding on him with this telephone so I could make him understand that this is serious. You know, I talked to my sister the other day, and her child had done something that was deeply upsetting, lied, disobeyed, gone out, left the door open, all of these things that potentially placed her in danger as a young woman in a large urban city in a poor neighborhood. And I said, well, what did you do? She said, I beat her. I had to beat her. I had to make her understand. And I said to her, but do you remember when Mama used to beat us to make us understand? And did we understand? Did the light go off? Did the magic happen for us that I've been beaten and I understand? You know? But what saddened me was I felt that she, and when we talked about it, the enormity of her feeling of powerlessness. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do to make her understand the seriousness of this situation. That she could have been raped. That she could have been battered. That the other children whom she left in the house with the door open could have been hurt. I didn't know how to make her understand the seriousness of that. So that I think that we are so bombarded right now with that tragic dimension, that tragic feeling of powerlessness. And it's interesting because she said to me that, you know, I'm going to find a therapist for her. And I said to her, but, you know, you may have to find a therapist for yourself to find out what is a more productive way I can intervene on this situation. I mean, this is a woman who has honed her feminist insights, a working class woman in America who has grown, who has broken out of the sexism in her domestic household, who has resisted. And yet, when faced with a situation of crisis, she falls back on those things that we always learned were the way to handle something and to make people understand. I think feminism has failed tremendously in our capacity to provide people with concrete ways that they can transform situations and concrete ways that we can enable people to understand. And I think that this is the task before us. And we cannot meet that task if we are not willing to vigilantly interrogate the violence in ourselves.
Bell Hooks, from her address to the 12th Annual Conference of the Texas Council on Family Violence in October 1993. This brilliant and extremely influential thinker died in December 2021. Her ideas live on. Wings is a weekly half-hour radio series covering the global women's movement and related issues, and distributed free of charge to community radio stations around the world. For more information, email wings@wings.org. Supporters in 2021 include community radio stations WERU and KMUD, Carolyn Byerly, the Women's Institute for Freedom of the Press, the International Association of Women in Radio and Television, U.S. Chapter, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning, and whose recent series of events can be viewed at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wing Sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Those are two pieces of community radio content borrowed from Canadian radio show Wings. Thanks again to Wings for letting us borrow those pieces of great radio. The second one you heard there was author and thinker Bell Hooks. If you'd like to email us here at In the Motherhood, you can email inthemotherhood@ckut.ca. That's it for us this month, and stay tuned for more great radio programming here on CKUT.
Mazel, Ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades, welcome to Amandla this week for here at CKUT 90.3 FM. Amandla Radio is brought to you by Doug Miller and Gwen Schulman on a weekly basis to bring you news and analysis and background on Africa, stuff you will not hear in the mainstream media. I'm going to look at the AFRICON. The Africa Cup of Nations is being played right now. It's been a very controversial competition. It's the national sides of African teams, 24 of them, and it's on in Cameroon right now. So I'll bring you in some background on that. And Gwen, what did you found some very interesting stuff.
Yes. Welcome to our listeners, to everybody. So this is an ongoing relationship and conversation that we have with the Oakland Institute down in